Good morning. As the elephant was about to attack, the Buddha spoke to him, suffusing him with all the love at his command. And stretching out his right hand, he stroked the animal's forehead. Thrilling with joy at the touch, Nalagiri the elephant sank on his knees before the Buddha, and the Buddha taught him the Dharma. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. It's the quote that's on the front of your program. It's a story. It's just a story. I'll tell you the rest of it in a little bit. But I want to talk a little bit about this story because we hear the word tame a lot in our tradition. We hear the word tame. We're here to tame the elephant. We're here to tame the wild horse. We're here to train or tame the puppy. And we're talking about the mind. We're taming the mind. And Buddhism, of course, comes to us from a culture where elephants were prevalent, right? 500 BC, northern India, elephants are a thing. People know what elephants are. And an elephant is a very powerful, very large animal. And so they start thinking, ooh, this is a good metaphor for the mind. It is very large. It is very powerful. It is not unusual to tie an elephant to a tree and have the elephant decide, I think I want to go far. And that tree goes, squish. It's not a problem because you're an elephant. It's a good metaphor for the power of the mind. Tame the elephant. So, as part of the Buddhist tradition, we say we tame the elephant. And we also claim to practice a tradition that is based in ahimsa, non-harm. Buddhism is based in the principle of non-harm, a fundamental stance of non-violence. Don't make it worse, right? I have to train an elephant. And I can't hurt anything. That's interesting. We claim to practice a tradition based on non-harm. And yet from moment to moment, we very often train our minds with violence. We train our minds very subtly with violence. Very subtly. Sometimes not subtly. Sometimes not subtly at all, but sometimes very subtly. What am I talking about? I'm talking about when you are given Zazen instruction and just align your posture and find your long spine and find your balance and find your mudra and bring your breath down into your belly and find your experience grounded in the moment, right? Present moment experience. And if you notice yourself wandering from present moment experience, bring it back. Does that sound familiar? More or less, right? The instruction we're not given is when your mind wanders, please get angry at it. Please know that it's a broken, bad mind. Busy's bad, right? And so when you're training your mind and you bring it back again, please shame yourself a little bit, could you? Just for a second or two, just remind yourself that you're bad at this. You're just really not improving at it because you've been doing it for a long, long time. Maybe this is the wrong tradition for you. Maybe this is the wrong practice for you. Maybe you're just not learning like everybody else is. They're sitting really quietly. All right. So based on your response, I am guessing you understand this subtle violence. It's violence. And maybe we do this, I don't know, maybe we do this because we've been given poor instruction. Maybe we do this because we think that's what taming is. Maybe that's how we imagine taming something is supposed to look like. And if we do think that, we come by that belief honestly. Because when we tame elephants for the circus, we mean we break them. When we tame a wild horse, we use the word break. If I break its spirit, it will be obedient to me. That is a tamed horse. Right? It is a tamed elephant. It'll balance the ball or ride on the little cart or do the thing I've told it to, because I have so sufficiently, quote-unquote, broken it, it fears what will happen to it if it doesn't do this more than it fears doing it. It will then do it. Right? I've been told we don't do elephants in circuses anymore. Is that true? I just learned that yesterday, actually. Somebody said, yeah, we don't do that anymore in this country. I don't know. I hope that's true. But anyway, you all know what I'm talking about, right? We all understand that. We've seen films of cattle prods, and we've seen whips, and we've seen, you know, you tame a lion, the guy's got a chair and a whip. I can defend against you, and I can hurt you, right? I'm hoping these, even if you are not a lion tamer, or even if you have not spent time in Byron Bailey Circus, I hope all these metaphors are familiar to you because of your life. Everybody in this room was trained with a chair and a whip, without exception. Sometimes the chair is bigger, sometimes the whip is bigger, sometimes it's a little tiny chair, and sometimes a little tiny whip, but baby, it's happening. That's how we get things to obey. That's how we get things to obey. That's how we were tamed. That's how we were trained, right? So then we fast forward a few decades, and we pick up something called meditation, because that sounds really cool. And so we start sitting on a cushion, and we start noticing, holy macaroni. That's the traditional response. In the Soto tradition, it's usually pasta-based. Wow, there's a lot going on in here. Oh, my goodness, I tell my mind to stop, and it won't. Oh, I tell myself not to feel sad, but I do. I tell myself to, wow, it's just I'm being dragged around. Oh, my God, it's like some sort of large animal. Maybe an elephant. Wow, this is like trying to train an elephant. I've got an elephant in my head. I've got an elephant in my heart. I've got an elephant in my body. It doesn't want to stay still. It wants to, it wants to, it wants to. And so I've been given the instruction to tame it. And I only know one way of doing that. I only know one way. How would I know another way? How would I know another way? If that's the way I was tamed, if that's the way all my friends were tamed, if that's the way society tames people, how would I know to do anything else? So of course when my mind wanders, it's a bad mind. It's not obeying the rule. What happens when you don't obey the rule? Of course when I say, stop churning emotions, and they don't, they're bad. Right? Wow. So maybe we just collectively understand that. That's what we do. And so the very act of coming here, we're actually quite high risk of turning this zendo into a circus. Right? We oftentimes talk about, oh, the bell rang, let the show begin. Because you know, we're going to watch the show. Watching the show is pretty different than trying to hurt it, than trying to control it, than trying to limit its influence, than trying to. The other thing we do with elephants, if we're going to put them in a circus, is we take them away from their natural surroundings. It's the very first thing we do. Right, they're used to having lots of room, lots of room. Both Indian elephants and African elephants, lots of space. We put them in a little tiny space. How do our Zafus show up being exactly that? How often is your meditation practice a little tiny cage? Put my mind in this little tiny cage and keep it there. When it wanders, I'm going to pull it back. I'm going to yank it back. I want to be good at this, and that's not good. This is good. You stay here. You feel it? what part of you wants it to come back and sit still? Can you feel that? What part of you is that? What part of you wants to break the mind, to control the mind, to tame the mind? What is that? Is that a wise part of you? A compassionate part of you? A spacious part of you? An allowing, accepting, loving part of you? No. That is a fearful, controlling part of you. Of course it is. Everybody has this, right? We're talking about it this way because if that's my starting point, if that's like actually the very first thing that happens to me, and it happens so thoroughly and happens so subtly to my mind when I walk into this building or when I walk over to my cushion at home that I don't even see, the entire project can be suffused with that spirit of violence. The entire thing. I don't even notice it. I don't even notice it. So, for those of you who have read Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, a lot of you have read Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, very famous, Suzuki Roshi, yes, all the paws go up, yes. You remember the sort of fronts piece, the page before the book properly starts, there's that lovely pull quote, it is wisdom which is seeking wisdom. It is wisdom which is seeking wisdom. I love that line, it's one of my all-time favorite top 10 lines ever. I just love it. I think about it all the time. This comes up in my life all the time. Part of why it's been so mysterious for me is because when I first read it, I went, that's wrong. That's stupid. Like, no, I'm deluded, and so I'm seeking to be wise. Hello? Maybe he's new. Maybe he doesn't know. Because clearly, like, if I have a sucker, I'm not around going around looking for suckers. I've already got one right here. See in my paw? I've got a sucker. I don't need one. If I had wisdom, I wouldn't be looking for it. Oh, wow. It took me a long time. It took me a long time to see that one. It's funny he doesn't say don't seek. He just says recognize that the part of you that wants that is that thing itself. So when my Zazen practice, when my meditation practice has its very first step be, I am here to control something. I have to recognize that's what that's about. Control seeks control. Right? What is that rooted in? Fear. My own suffering. My own suffering. Why do we want control so much? I mean, I've got an imaginary picture of me being able to control my mind. Why is that attractive to me? I actually think it's a really good question to get really intimate with. Like, if you could snap your fingers and say, I now can control my mind, that'd be great. It'd be like Buddhism 101, except you could just take it in pill form and boom, you've arrived because you think that's the mission of Buddhism and I can now control my mind. Okay, why is that desirable? Why? Like, how come? Honestly, how come? Go all the way down to the bottom of that. Why? Why? Because I'm scared if I don't have control. And if I have it, I would be good. I mean, do you get it? It's a tremendously childlike place. And then it's also, therefore, a universal place that 7.5 billion of us have. When I feel insecure and I feel scared and I feel afflicted, I seek control. Of course I do. Of course I do. And if my starting point on the cushion is how do I control this experience, that's what that will end up being. It's all it ever can be. Increased sense of control. Right? And there's a tremendous violence there. I've taken my mind out of its natural habitat. When you come to Zen Center, no greedy thoughts. No, 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 no. It's one of the poisons, I think, right? No, no, no greedy. No anger. No delusion. Ooh, I'm not even sure what that is, but okay, none of that, none of that, none of that. And so none of like, oh, I'm so hungry. Oh, God, no, that's greed. Okay, so bad. No, stay out, 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 out. I'll put you in an even smaller cage. Oh, God. Okay, okay, okay. Yeah, I'm not hungry anymore. I'm not hungry anymore. I'm not hungry anymore. God, that person next to me is breathing so loud. She just pressed me. Pressed me. Oh, there's hate. Oh, no. Oh, my God, it's in me. Okay, okay, so none of that, none of that, none of that, none of that. Happy family. Happy family. Right? My God, my elephant's in a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller cage all the time. Every time it wanders, I'm whipping it again. Not that, this. You're going to go over here and you're going to... Can you feel that energy? Were all of you trained that way? Yes. No one in the room is nodding, but everyone in the room was trained like this. Okay. Okay. So when you are at Zen Center, or when you are at home, or when you're in the pew at church, or when you are doing your bows at the mosque, wherever it is you feel that you are the most connected to the deepest part of yourself, and greed arises in your heart, what do you do? I think that's a hugely important question. Because honestly, for me, most of the time, like I assume most people, I kick it out. You don't belong here. You are bad. I am here. I am trying to be good. This is a place of goodness. I'm with other good people, so out. When hate arises in the mind, what do I do with it? I disown. I distance. I suppress. I repress. I deny. Wow. If Zen was about lack of intimacy and separation, I would be doing my practice really well. Unfortunately, and very fortunately, Zen is about the opposite of that. So we have this lovely story about the Buddha training an elephant that includes the detail. It's a story, I know, it's just a story, but it includes the detail of the Buddha touching the elephant, physically touching it with his paw. He puts his paw right up there and touches it. I'm not giving it an order from across the town square. I'm not controlling it with my amazing mind. I'm not running successfully in the opposite direction. I am not prodding it. He has no whip. He has no chair. The metaphor of the mind, this big raging rah, and his answer is to touch it. He touches it. I hope that's what your Zazen feels like. I hope that's what your Zazen feels like. When hate arises in your heart, oh, hi, I see you. I recognize you as suffering. I know that you're suffering. I understand. I will touch you. Here you are. When greed arises, oh, hi. That's got a totally different texture, doesn't it? Very different texture to it. I can touch that one, too. How about sadness? How about grief? Aversion, loneliness. You know the list. You are the list. How would that be different? How would this Zendo go from being a circus to a jungle? Is it possible to still tame with kindness? Is that actually what we mean by tame? Maybe tame means to make a friend of, to befriend, to become intimate with. Ah, that's actually the spirit, right? Isn't that actually the spirit of tame? And how easily we misunderstand that, how easily we turn that into breaking, controlling, limiting, forcing, right? So, we have this story, which I'll read to you. I really want to tell you where it comes from. I don't know. Based on the way the words are arranged on the page and some of the little symbols that they put around the letters and stuff, I'm guessing it's translated into English from Sanskrit. Because some of the demarcations are not what we normally see. The story is about an attempt on the Buddha's life. Evidently that happened, at least according to our kind of collective scripture on his life. People were trying to kill him a lot. It sort of makes sense. It's just kind of what we tend to do. When Buddha arises in your mind, you usually try to kill him too. It's just what we do. So we have Buddha's cousin Devadatta, who's the villain of the piece. He's the one who's trying to kill his brother. Devadatta, after several vain attempts to kill the Buddha, obtained Ajasattu's consent to use Nalagiri, the elephant, as a means of ensuring the Buddha's death. The elephant, he says, knows nothing of the Buddha's virtues and will have no hesitation in destroying him. Nalagiri was a very fierce animal, and in order to increase his fierceness, Devadatta instructed his keeper to give him twice the usual amount of intoxicant. This is a metaphor. Okay, that's interesting. Proclamation was made by the beating of drums that the streets of the city should be cleared as Nalagiri would be let loose upon them. When the Buddha was informed of this and warned against going into the city for his alms, he ignored the warning. At the sight of Nalagiri the elephant, all the people fled in terror. Ananda, seeing the elephant advancing toward the Buddha, went in spite of the Buddha's orders to the contrary, stood in front of the Buddha, who had to make use of his supernatural power to remove him from his place. So Ananda jumps in to protect him, and Buddha says, nope, poof. He uses supernatural power to do that. I'm just saying it. It's in the Pali Canon, folks. We 21st century Zen folks get very cranky about that stuff. Well, what's rational science? Yeah, and he's got supernatural powers, baby, and he's moving people around. So just so you know, that's part of the tradition. Love it or don't, it's part of our tradition. But actually, in the course of this story, that detail becomes extremely important. Extremely important, because he removes Ananda. He needs no protection. Please, go be safe. I need you to go be safe. I do not need you to protect me. Just then, a woman carrying a child saw the elephant coming, and she fled, and in her terror, she dropped the child at the Buddha's feet. As the elephant was about to attack the child, the Buddha spoke to him, suffusing him with all the love at his command, and stretching out his right hand, he stroked the animal's forehead. Thrilling with joy at the touch, Nalagiri sank on his knees before the Buddha, and the Buddha taught him the Dharma. I don't know how that is for you folks. I feel that. The line that gets me is thrilling with joy at the touch. Right? So this is a symbol. This animal has been driven mad by intoxicants, right? He has been prodded and poked and driven crazy. He is in a rage. He's an animal. You are too. You know what it's like to be in a rage. You know what it's like to feel poked and prodded and driven to a place where you're not you anymore. You're not you anymore. You're just your defenses. You're just your reactivity. Right? Right? That part of you is right there all the time. Part of your hardwiring. The reason the detail about removing Ananda with supernatural power is so important is here comes the elephant charging, about to kill you, right? You're the Buddha. And the baby, the defenseless, right? So use your supernatural power, baby. I mean, poof him. Come on. You've just shown you can do it. You could just easily do that. Poof him over there. Or poof the baby over to its mom. Or poof yourself out of the way. I mean, come on, right? Why isn't he poofing? He's got supernatural power. He's just shown it. He poofed Ananda. Oh, sweetie, out of the way, poof. He doesn't. He stands there and he says, he meets him with words of kindness and touches the madness, the pain, the rage. He touches it. There's the supernormal power that Zen is entirely about, folks. That is where we live and breathe, right there. That is our supernatural power. Chopping wood, carrying water, we call it. The activities of daily life. And one of the activities of daily life is meeting affliction with love. Just touching it with an open hand. Just touching it. Is that not supernatural? That's what we want. We're not here to be able to poof people. We can't. That's fine. We're not lacking anything, because what we do have is that second one, to just touch it. And when this writer, whoever wrote this, and of course there's a translator involved here too, I'm realizing, thrilled with the joy of the touch. When your greed shows up, does it want the chair? Does it want the whip? Does it? Or, oh, you're hungry, aren't you? I see that you're in pain. The angriest part of you. Does it want the chair? Does it want the whip? Oh, you're so angry. You've been hurt, haven't you? My hand is open. I'm not harming you. I'm not judging you. I'm not shaming you. You belong in the Zendo. You belong on the Zafu. That's what I've come here to do, to make peace with the universe. And my suffering is a huge part of that in the world of this little tiny brain. It eclipses the whole thing. That's me solving the problem of suffering, addressing it directly. Hi, suffering. I see you. I see you. You're rampaging today, aren't you? Here's my paw. I'm touching you. Do you kind of get it? Just that fundamental stance is, if you are going to bow down before me, you will do it out of love and connection and devotion. Not because I beat you enough or shamed you enough or separated myself from you enough or ignored you enough or ran enough or right? Over and over and over, our suffering arises in our consciousness over and over. is doing it right now for you. Right now. In this very moment, if I said, think of 10 things that would make your immediate experience more pleasant, you'd have no problem thinking of 10 things. This is a hot room. The first five might be ice cream related. Of course you'd be able to think of them. You're alive. You're born. It's way too late. It's way too late. Of course you're afflicted. Yes, that's the human experience. You're born, you're afflicted. Ta-da! Wow. I can fight against that my whole life. I can totally just fight against that and rail against that my entire life. My entire life can be nothing but defenses against that. All failing, of course. All failing. But that's what that can be. There's a million ways of poofing elephants and running away from elephants and shocking them and cheering them and whipping them and leaving them and ignoring them and denying them. I mean, of course, you can totally do that. You can put it in smaller and smaller and smaller cage. That's what most of us do most of the time. And the Buddha is offering us another way. Another way. So the gesture, the touching, this image has been famous, of course, in all the years of Buddhist teachers riffing on scriptures. This touching has become kind of an archetypal symbol of meeting affliction with compassion, of meeting suffering with love and acceptance, right? So a lot of you have heard this story. It's not new. And so a lot of you are also familiar with the other thing I put on the front of your little programs today, the mudra, the Abhaya mudra, which is just the palm up, the right hand traditionally, the palm up facing outward, the Abhaya mudra. Usually this gesture is associated with fearlessness, expressing fearlessness and bestowing fearlessness. It harkens back to this story, at least in some variations of the Buddhist tradition. They say, oh, right, this is a reference to how he tames. It's how, this is the gesture. This is how he tames his elephant, by meeting that pain with acceptance and with love, right? It's fearlessness. He's not afraid of the elephant. And through his interaction with the elephant becomes not afraid too, right? Joy is contagious. Fearlessness is contagious. Hate is contagious. You get it. Emotions are contagious, right? The Buddha is the archetype of compassionate presence. He has no agenda other than just meeting something, and that's contagious. And so the elephant's experience is transformed, right? So that's what that image is about. I don't think we have any Buddhas in this building that have that. You know what? The one in the men's changing room. We have a little closet. Oh, is over there, is he doing Abhaya? Yeah, the fearlessness. It's not unusual, and what's also typical, so a lot of you have seen this, even though we don't see it as much in Zen, is the posture, you know, it's the Buddha image, and, you know, he's sitting meditation there with a nice long spine and soft belly and open chest. And the one hand is raised in this fearlessness mudra, and the other one is just resting open in his lap as the meditation piece, right? Compassion and wisdom. This is the active, the right hand, the going forward and touching is seen as the active principle in meditation, the compassion principle, right? Compassion is active, right? And then the other hand, the left hand resting in his lap this way is the receptive. The receptive, the wisdom piece, wisdom and compassion. It's just another variation on our cosmic mudra, you know, wisdom and compassion being formed into a circle. Here we have just a variation. What I like about this image, though, the image you have in your program, is there's a lotus that the artist has put in the palm. It's not the best. I've got a black and white copy there, but anyway, you get it. The palm of his hand is a lotus. The palm of his hand is a lotus. And, of course, in our tradition, the lotus represents enlightenment. Enlightenment, the perfection of wisdom married to the perfection of compassion. Activity married to passivity. Masculine and feminine, if you wish. So that's our practice. that's our invitation. When we set our alarm a little early so we can get up before we go to work and spend some time sitting, being intimate with our experience, daring to be intimate with our experience. We're always stepping into that town square, and we don't know if there are elephants there today or not. We don't know if there are babies or people fleeing in terror, people going about their business. We don't know what we're going to expect. We don't know what we're going to get. But the mudra, the story, the vow, is to be intimate. It is to be accepting. It is to investigate, to connect, to get closer to. If I find suffering here, I will meet it with compassion. If I find suffering in this world, I will meet it with compassion. That's the Bodhisattva vow, essentially, right? If I find suffering, I'll meet it with compassion. And all I'm really doing is reminding myself, and you, because you're here, how often the one place that doesn't happen is the zendo, the cushion, the meditation. Because when my suffering arises there, I have a tendency to push it away. I have a tendency to meet it with a very subtle violence. And I know that that violence pervades my day because it can't not. Right? The ripples. I don't get to control where they go. And if I'm subtly violent to myself for 40 minutes, that's going to ripple out. It took me years to notice this, you guys. It took me years to notice. I bet you it was 10 years on the cushion before I noticed. Every time my mind wanders, I scold myself before I bring it back. It took me 10 years to notice that because it happens in about an eighth of a second. It's just that fast, right? But at the end of Zazen, after doing that, how many times has your mind wandered during Zazen? Many, many, right? I've subtly done that to myself many, many times over 40 minutes. And if I'm here for two sittings, double it. If I'm here for a whole day of meditation, quadruple it. If I'm here for a weekend, I run out of words. If I'm here for Rohatsu, how many times for an eighth of a second did I just say, bad boy, failed again, one more time? Why? What is that? Why is sitting with busy mind bad? One of the key things about Zen is to go all the way back to the given, the thing we think we take for granted, the given. I want a still mind. How come? Like, literally, how come? Why do you want that? What is it you imagine about this thing called still mind that you imagine is preferable to the mind you have now? You should really look at that. And it would also be interesting for you to notice, why do you imagine that's a separate mind than the one you have now? I want a really still lake, not this crappy wavy one. Do you have to go to a different lake? What? Why do you want that? What is it about that? Is that experience unacceptable? Is that a suffering you can't be with? Or do you imagine you're bad? What's going on there? Go all the way down, right? So that's what this story is about. And I hope, you have experienced in your life thrilling to the touch of having a fever and having somebody bring you over a cold cloth to put on your forehead, and your whole body goes, thank you. My fever isn't gone. I'm not well. But you have met my pain with compassion. That cool compress on my forehead feels so good. Thank you. Thank you for not performing an exorcism on me or yelling at me or telling me to get up and shake it off, right? You could have. All of us have had that experience too. Your hand with its lotus is your mind, and you get to do that for yourself every single time your mind wanders, every single time you get angry, every single time you get greedy, every single time you get lonely or sad or scared or bored or you name it. When that shows up on the cushion, you get to be that hand, you get to be that cold compress, you get to be grandma, you get to be whatever that looks like for you that says, hi, I see you, it's okay. I'm right here, I gotcha, you're fine. There's a calm elephant. Isn't that ironic? It's what you wanted from the beginning. And how did you get there? By accepting the fact it was really hurting. Right? That's how you do it. That's how you do it. Super simple, but not easy. Not easy at all. It takes years of practice. So I'm going to close with, some of you know Thomas Keating, Father Keating. Some of you know Father Keating. He's a, I think he's still alive. I'm embarrassed I don't know that. He's a huge proponent of meditation in the Christian tradition. Keating and Basil Pennington were huge pioneers in opening up the tradition called centering, what they call centering prayer. We would call it Zazen or something very close it, close to it. And Susan, you guys know Susan Nelson, who's upstairs right now teaching. Antro sent me this a couple days ago because she mentioned it at the leadership group meeting that she had been working with this prayer. And I was really moved by it, so I thought I'd offer it to you because it's exactly what we're talking about today. This is the welcoming prayer. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I welcome everything that comes to me today because I know it is for my healing. I welcome all thoughts, feelings, emotions, people, situations, and conditions. I let go of my desire for power and control. I let go of my desire for affection, esteem, approval, pleasure. I let go of my desire for survival and security. I let go of my desire to change any situation, any condition, any person, or myself. I open to the love and presence of God and God's action within. Amen. Wow, that's a pretty radical prayer. That's a really radical prayer. As Buddhists, we'd probably tweak that last line. Unless you think God is love and compassion, then you don't need to. Leave it right the way it is. You understand the radicalness of the surrender. And that's the radicalness of the surrender from the story, too. This giant monster, this giant flailing beast called an elephant can kill me like that. Just like that. Break me in half. That's how big the surrender is. Is that how big your rage feels sometimes? How big your greed feels sometimes? How big your loneliness feels sometimes? Can you still dare yourself to touch it, to just touch it? This is our vow. As bodhisattvas, this is our vow. As we allow ourselves to care. When help is possible, we let ourselves care and then we help. When help is not possible, we let ourselves care. And caring hurts and it helps. And it keeps all of us alive. If you have not received caring in a while, if you have not thrilled at the touch of being cared about, please ask for it. Go to somebody that you love or care for and say, can you do something for me? Can you just tell me? Can you just tell me, please? I really need that. And watch what happens. And then watch how you can do that for yourself and watch how you can do that for others. The willingness to feel. The one who cries and the one who cries for. The one who receives, the one who gives. The giver, the receiver, the gift. All right. Well, I thank you for your attention today. We got a few minutes here. If you'd like to add your voice to the room or ask any questions or comments or anything, John.
I know, obviously, for the purpose of these stories, the elephant was used as a symbol of, you know, rage and strength and can be out of control. And what's interesting is, of course, modern research now is showing how elephants actually are incredibly attached to family, whether they mourn their dead, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like the Buddha really didn't give it something that wasn't already given.
Want to switch seats? There it is. There it is. Same lake as choppy, same lake as calm. Same mind that's so full of affliction is also the mind that's spacious. That's exactly right. What I love about the way that they use that image in that story is he's just helping return it. And I want to say it's true nature because that is part of its true nature. Calm, present. But anger is also part of its nature. That's just part of the deal, right? So it isn't like bad elephant, good elephant, broken elephant, healed elephant. It's just elephant. But that's exactly right. I love that. Did you guys all hear what he said? Could you hear? What are you saying in the back? Okay, I'm just aware of the sound in this space. Anything else today?
you know how when you go back to your breath from the discursive thought, how we often talk about it as just going back to your breath, but to me that seems like ignoring the thought, so that kind of ties into like maybe like a subtle kind of violence.
Yeah.
And I think that act of going back to your breath is actually a very complicated and deep and powerful thing. And so it may be easy to just say, just go back to your breath, but it's really much more than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that. Could everybody hear that? Did that make sense? You're right. I'm right with you, actually, on that. And, you know, the tradition gives so little instruction. I mean, the Soto Zen tradition gives next to nothing when it comes to Zazen, right? I mean, we've got Fukan's Zengi, but we have, what, 3 lines or 2 lines or something. So when we're upstairs doing intro, we're giving way more than Keizan or Dogen or those guys ever would have given. And the word just, you really were... Yeah. Punching the word just there, and I love it because it's like it's working both ways. Like, just come back. Like, don't stop and judge and criticize. Oh, then I really like the just. And yet I'm also aware, oh, just could have the very, just what you're pointing to, Matt, that sort of subtle, you're not doing the right thing, so go back to doing the right thing. It can almost feel kind of clinical. And I don't know about you guys, but, you know, if you sit long enough sitting or a retreat where you're doing subsequent, and you just focus on the one, if you really bring your mind in just the one, just the thumb tips or the breath or the tip of the nostril or whatever, you can get pretty tranced out. I mean, yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a place to go. Okay, cool. But what I love about what you're implying is, to what extent am I doing that to avoid the thing that's connected to those thoughts that actually hurts me? Because if my mind is really busy, it's like, oh, how come you're so busy? I'm scared. It's like, of course you're scared. How come I keep thinking about the future? How come I'm always planning? Well, what is planning about? Something might happen that might be bad. I might be scared. Oh, okay. So there's a feeling under there, right? Trying to show up. And one of the ways it's showing up is a really busy mind. So it's like, oh, there's some suffering here that needs attending to. And so you're right. Me going, just the breath starts being like a scalpel. And you can sort of feel...
Compassionate observation is more than that.
Exactly. It really is, Matt, yeah. And it is subtle. It's difficult to talk about. It's really difficult to talk about, but I love the subtlety there. Isn't it funny how the more we do this, the more, I mean, awareness gets subtle, right? All of you, I know you know, even if you've only sat once in your life, you'd notice there was something you saw that you didn't see before. Our awareness gets more and more and more subtle, so we start to see the layers, right? The ways in which we are defended against, the ways in which we do continue to impose our agenda or idea or belief system or the way in which we're still informed by our prejudices and our biases. And wow, we get really good. Don't we? Isn't that exciting? Transformation is possible. Elephants are befriendable. What did you have?
I didn't see that. We all go through turbulence, and I feel like something that has really helped me is something you don't really visit often is acceptance and forgiveness.
Yeah.
And those feelings.
Yeah.
And just to own it and to know that they're there. And to connect that to a mind-body experience.
For sure, the connection piece, right? Mm-hmm. So that it's not just cognitive or not just abstract.
You're accepting it, you're forgiving it, and you're just going back to your breath.
Yeah. I love that piece. Thank you. Yeah, the angry elephant's the angry elephant. I mean, Buddha's got to accept it as, oh, you're really freaked out right now. I get that. Okay, cool. I've been freaked out. How come we don't have any stories in our tradition about the Buddha just getting freaked out? I could use one or two. One of my very favorite stories from Pali Canon is the Buddha sits down and he arranges his robes and he starts to deliver his Dharma discourse and 5,000 people get up and leave. I don't know. Maybe it's just sitting in this seat. But I'm like, that's really comforting. I've never had 5,000 people walk out of me. Yes. Wow. Maybe it's just him having a bad day. Okay. Thank you all for your attention. I am grateful to you.